All right, now this whole thing about this write-up in the manual about the factory, it's all a made-up story. Obviously, probably it's obvious. I'm just going to tell you the truth of what this story is actually misleading you from, so you actually know what's going on. We are investigating enzyme activity today. In other words, we're trying to measure how well an enzyme works in different situations. All right? In each of the two experiments, you change a variable to see whether that affects the enzyme activity, basically. That's generally speaking what we're doing. But the enzyme specifically that you're working with, even though I don't think the manual gives this away, is called lactase. Obviously an enzyme from its name, right? This is another example of an enzyme that's named for its normal substrate, which is lactose. Correct. Lactase is the enzyme. Lactose is the normal substrate. Now, what is lactose? It's not milk. It's milk sugar. That's what it linguistically means. Lactation is production of milk, right? Lact means milk. So lactose means milk sugar. It's not the whole milk, but it's sugar that's found in milk and other places as well. But chemically speaking, in terms of macromolecules, what is lactose? What kind of sugar is lactose? Not quite. Not big enough for polysaccharide. It's a disaccharide, like table sugar is, sucrose. Except sucrose is a disaccharide made out of two different things compared to the two things that make up lactose. All right? The job of lactase, the enzyme, is to speed up the hydrolysis, the breaking apart of lactose, which means breaks the glycosidic linkage between the two constituent monosaccharides. And therefore, if the enzyme works well, you would get two products. The two monosaccharides that are hooked together in the form of lactose would be on their own. So what are those two monosaccharides? Well, one of them is glucose. The other is galactose. Okay? Glucose and galactose, when they are bonded by a glycosidic linkage, make the disaccharide called lactose. If you want to break down lactose, catabolize it, hydrolyze it, you can use the enzyme lactase to speed that up, and you will form glucose and galactose, two monosaccharides. Everyone on the same page there? So, back to our goal. We're trying to assess how well an enzyme works in a given set of conditions. We're assessing enzyme activity. The higher the activity, the better the enzyme is working in that particular situation or that set of conditions. So the question then is, how do you assess enzyme activity? Well, if the enzyme is doing its job, that means in a given amount of time, you should see a lot of product form from substrate originally. Substrate is the reactant before the reaction happens. Product is what is created if the reaction happens, right? So the substrate is lactose, and it forms two products, glucose and galactose. If the enzyme's not working, then substrate does not get turned into product, at least not very much. If the enzyme's not working at all, you're just stuck with lactose, right? But the general question of how well is the enzyme working you can look at as two ways. In other words, you can assess it two different ways. You can assess it, you can measure it, that is, by measuring the disappearance of substrate. Because if it's working well, substrate should disappear. It's getting turned into product. Or you could assess it, the same activity, by measuring the appearance of product. Because if it's working, you should start having an accumulation of product, right? Either one of those tactics would work. And actually, there's three tactics here because there's two products. You could measure the disappearance of lactose in a given amount of time, or the appearance of glucose in the same amount of time, or the appearance of galactose in the same amount of time. Either one of those would work to give you a value for the activity of lactase, the enzyme. But here's the problem with this. We are not obviously going to go in there and count individual monosaccharides or disaccharides. There's trillions and trillions of them in a small drop. So we need an indirect way of figuring out how much of this stuff is in a volume of liquid. In other words, we need a measurement technique that is an indirect way to measure concentration. And that is a new technique for you, probably, that we haven't done in here before. That technique, that indirect way of measuring concentration, is called spectrophotometry. That's the technique. The instrument used for spectrophotometry is a spectrophotometer. And you have one in your plastic box here. You can go ahead and open up that box to take a look at it. It's just a little black box, pretty compact compared to the old-fashioned ones. They used to be much bigger. And not yet, but when I'm done with my lecture today, in order to operate the spectrophotometers, you're going to need a computer. So you'll be getting laptops from the chest over there. Let me just say this one time, hopefully only one time. When you put your computers back, it's really important that you not just close them. You have to shut them all the way down and make sure they're plugged in and charging before you leave. Otherwise, the next class is going to have nothing to work with. Right? And the whole thing can overheat if you don't turn them actually off. But anyway, you'll log on to those with your normal MEID. It should be no problem using them. A spectrophotometer is kind of a simple device. You're not going to open up the black box to look inside, but I can tell you basically what's under the hood. In a spectrophotometer, you have a well. It's the little black, it's the little square hole in the instrument. The well is where you put your sample, but not directly. You don't pour anything into that. That would be bad on the instrument. You have to put a special tube containing your sample into that well. And the special tubes for spectrophotometers are called cuvettes. C-U-V-E-T-T-E. I'm not going to touch any of these because none of you should touch them either with your bare hands. But they're little plastic square tubes that fit right in there. All right. Don't touch them until you have gloves on. And that's because, not for your own safety, but you don't want to get any of your oils onto the surface of the cuvette, because light has to pass through that in order to measure the concentration, and that will block the light and give you a wrong measurement. Anyway, there's a well in the instrument. That's where your sample is. At the other end is a lamp. It emits light. Now, it emits white light. White light is a combination of all the humanly visible colors. And color really isn't something that the light has. Color is an event in our brain. But anyway, different wavelengths of light cause perceptions of different colors in our brain. So when we say different colors of light, we're talking about different wavelengths of light. Light is electromagnetic energy. So it exists as waves, and the wavelength is the distance from one crest to another. So this is a longer wavelength than this. And therefore, these would cause different color sensations in our brain. But white light is a combination of all kinds of different waves, wavelengths. All right? Combination of all colors. Humanly visible colors. That's what's coming out of the lamp. Right after that lamp, there's a prism. In some models it's a prism, in some others it's a diffraction grating, but let's just call it a prism. Now when you send white light through a prism, you get the cover of Dark Side of the Moon, right? Which is the white light refracts or bends at different angles depending on the wavelength. And so out the other side comes a rainbow of colors. Each one, because it's bent differently, each color is going its own direction. The reason this is important is because spectrophotometry gives you a measurement of what the concentration is based on whether light gets absorbed by the sample. I just called light waves. It has wave-like properties, but it also has particle-like properties. Not a particle of with mass, but a particle of energy called a photon. All right? Photons are little packets of energy, of light energy. And when a photon encounters an object, there's a couple possibilities. One is that it can just go right through it, like light comes through a window. In other words, it can be transmitted through the object. Another is that it gets reflected. It'll bounce off in some new direction. And the third possibility is that the photon will get absorbed by whatever the particle is. And we call, in science, particles that absorb photons in the humanly visible range, pigments. And spectrophotometry is related to that. What we're going to do is send light toward the well where the sample is. So this is the top. You would put your sample in there and the light would encounter, it would go through the liquid that's in your sample. But it's trillions and trillions of photons that make up that light. And you're trying to determine relatively how many of those photons don't make it all the way through because they get absorbed by the solute particles in your sample. All right? So at the far end of this, after the well, is a collecting screen that will form an electrical output that will read as a number on your instrument or on the computer based on how many photons strike it. The more photons that strike the panel, the less absorption occurred by your sample, right? And this is why you can measure concentration. If you set this instrument up with just the amount of, just the right kind of light, the right color, it happens to be the right color of light that the substance you have in your sample absorbs, then the less light that makes it through, the greater must have gotten absorbed, and therefore the greater the concentration. That all clear? This is why you have the prism. By calibrating the instrument, you can turn this prism so that just the right color is the only color going in the straight line, then we'll hit the sample. The rest of it will just be bounced off to the side and not used. So spectrophotometry requires some preparation. You can't use the instrument unless you first calibrate it, and you also have to be able to, you have to already know what the proper wavelength or color of light that particular kind of solute that you're working with absorbs well. That's what you set the instrument up with a particular light, with a particular wavelength for. Okay? So the instrument actually reads, you can configure it to have two different outputs. Transmittance, which is the amount that gets through, and that's not what we want to set the instrument to. We want it set to absorbance, which is the inverse of that. It figures out that based on how much makes it through, it figures out what the absorbance is, how much does not make it through. Okay? An absorbance is an example of a quantity that is dimensionless, meaning it doesn't have any units. It actually has two units, but they cancel. They're the same units divided, one divided by the other, so the units cancel. We call that a dimensionless quantity. Okay, now, here's the problem in reality. You can't use a spectrophotometer if what you're trying to measure the concentration of does not absorb any of the light that the spectrophotometer can deliver. If the light for the whole range of the instrument just goes through that stuff, then you can't use the instrument, right? It's basically that kind of solute would be invisible to the spectrophotometer, in a sense. Undetectable is a better word, not invisible. So it only works with solutes that absorb photons in some part of the visible range. Well, lactose is not detectable. Light will just go right through it. So you can't use the spectrophotometer to measure the disappearance of substrate, like I said, would be one possibility, because you can't detect lactose with this instrument. Glucose is also undetectable by this instrument. So you can't measure enzyme activity by measuring the accumulation of glucose. And you can't measure galactose either with this instrument. So those are the only three possibilities for the normal operation of this enzyme. None of them works with a spectrophotometer. That's why we can't use lactose as our substrate. Even though it's part of the experiment, part of the backstory, we can't use lactose as the substrate that will give us an observable product. Instead, we have to use a surrogate or a replacement substrate. Enzymes are specific, remember, meaning that the substrate has to have just the right shape, but an enzyme can have more than one possible substrate if they're similarly shaped, just like a lock can be operated by two slightly different keys. A master key, for instance, and just the personal key. Right, that's right. So this surrogate substrate that we're going to use is ONPG. Now you've probably guessed that that is an acronym. It's what we call it because it's a lot easier than saying what it stands for, which is orthonitrophenyl beta D galactopyranoside. That's what ONPG officially stands for. But as complex as that name is, it's very similar to lactose, which is why it can also be a substrate for the same enzyme lactase. Okay? Just like lactose is made out of two parts hooked together, so is ONPG. And just like lactose can be broken into those two parts, so can ONPG. The two parts for ONPG are galactose and
O-nitrophenol.
O stands for ortho, just like it does here. All right. OMPG is also invisible to the instrument. So we're stuck there. Once again, even using this other substrate, we still can't measure disappearance of substrate because we can't detect substrate. Galactose is one of the products. I've already told you that it's invisible to that. But O-nitrophenol does absorb photons. And that's why we can detect it with a spectrophotometer. And the fact that it absorbs photons, like pigments do, is why it looks a certain color to us. It looks yellowish to us. So you can visually, qualitatively assess how well the enzyme worked by looking at how yellow the liquid gets after a certain amount of time in that condition. Because the more yellow it gets, the more O-nitrophenol has built up, which means the enzyme was working well to split it into the two products. But you can't put a number to it that way, right? That's just a qualitative assessment using your eyes, saying a little bit yellow, more yellow. The spectrophotometer can actually quantify it, give you a number for the concentration by basically reading how many of those photons get absorbed by O-nitrophenol particles. And the higher the concentration, the more absorption is going to take place. So the higher the absorption number on your instrument today that the computer will measure, the better the enzyme has worked in that condition. Now, another important thing about a spectrophotometer is that it never gives you an absolute measurement. An absolute measurement is one that stands on its own. It's always a relative measurement, meaning it only makes sense when you compare it to another measurement. And the other measurement that you compare it to is part of preparing the instrument. You have to compare it to a measurement of a tube that contains everything that your samples do except no solute of interest. Okay? We call that solution, whatever it is, the blank, because it doesn't have anything in it that you're looking for. And when you put that into the instrument, you can use it to zero the instrument. So you put that blank in, you subject it to the right color of light. Even though it doesn't have any O-nitrophenol in it, which is what your solute of interest is today, that doesn't mean that 100% of the light is going to get through it, because some of it's going to go get refracted away. Some of it might be absorbed by the glass a little bit. Some light's going to make it through, though, right? A lot of the light's going to make it through, just not all. Well, however much makes it through, since this doesn't contain any solute that you're looking for, we call that 100% of the light got through. And conversely, zero got absorbed. You tell the instrument, call this zero absorption. And then, after it's zeroed, you put in a sample that might have some O-nitrophenol in it, and that measurement only makes sense when you compare it to the zero. If you don't zero the instrument, the number is meaningless. That all makes sense? Now, when you zero this instrument, it takes a little bit of time, and you just follow the instructions on the little laminated card. Follow those exactly. Don't go on to the next step until you make sure you've done it each step correctly. The zeroing takes a little bit of time, but the nice thing is that you only have to zero it once. Once your instrument is correctly zeroed, don't get rid of your blank, because you might have made a mistake and you have to go back and re-zero it. So save your blank, but once you have it zeroed, getting your data is really quick, because each of your samples, one by one, you just put that into the well, wait a few seconds until the number stabilizes and write that number down. Okay? You don't have to zero it in between samples, in other words. One important thing about these cuvettes, though, is that even though you can fit a square tube cuvette into a square hole four different ways, there's a correct way to put these in and incorrect ways as well. What you'll see when you can finally touch these is that one face of the tube has a little triangle on it, and you have to line that up with the little triangle that's on the instrument face. If you put it in sideways, it's a different thickness of liquid that the light is going to go through, so it'll give you the wrong measurement. That's why it has a directionality to it. So pay attention to that when you put your cuvettes in your instrument. All right? You've waited well longer than 30 minutes, so you can proceed with the rest of the actual setup. And then while someone is doing that, if you want to save time, while someone is collecting the tubes and finishing up the experiment, another person in the group can get the spectrophotometer up and ready. Okay? All right, we'll see how it goes.